Show.
I'm proud to say Eric made me who I am today.
A man who lives in a car wash and goes by the name Uncle Sudsy Wudsy.
And now your host, Eric Metaxas.
I had no idea. Todd, I'm so sorry. I had no idea that you lived in a car wash, nor that you went by the name Uncle Sudsy Wudsy. My apologies to Todd Wilkerson in general. Folks, this is one of those hours where I get to have more fun than usual. I usually have a lot of fun talking about things that interest me and I hope interest you. But this hour, I get again to speak with David Bahnsen, who has written a book called Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. David Bahnsen, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Great to be back.
And welcome to the studio. You're here in the studio. You know that we're being videotaped. Did you know that?
He did tell me.
It makes me very nervous because the camera's right there. It's an all-seeing eye. We're just going to put it out of our minds. Your book, we spoke about your book, I don't know if it was a month or so ago, and I was so fascinated. It's so rich. The subject is so rich. I said, I want to get you back as soon as possible. So for those who missed the first show we did together, reprise, if you would, the basics of your thesis.
So essentially, the book is attempting to identify what I believe to be a bipartisan problem throughout the culture. It's not written as a political diatribe, but rather a sort of cultural indictment around a society that has abdicated individual responsibility and identifying the source of so many of our problems. And it goes to all sorts of different topical issues and addressing those issues from the vantage point of, if there were a greater individual responsibility that started bottom up, would we not be able to rectify some of the challenges from the housing? The financial crisis is a big area that we address in the book, to the trade debates and jobs and all these different kind of economic challenges, but even some of the great cultural issues we're dealing with. And so my underlying thesis is that, in fact, this is something new. It is actually something unique versus past generations. The ethos of American responsibility has undergone a fundamental change since the 1960s.
Well, riff with me, if you would, on the possible provenance of this phenomenon. In other words, we're talking about something, we're saying it's unprecedented. Any other generation, you think of the pioneers of the 19th century, you think of the greatest generation of the 20th century. The idea of rugged individualism, of people taking responsibility for themselves, it was baked into the culture. It was part of the ethos of, I would say, most of the West, but certainly the United States. So the question is, what happened to lead us to this point? So when you talk about a crisis of responsibility, first of all, when we talk about victimhood, in other words, something happened after the sexual revolution when the PC culture began to invade the academy, the media, after it invaded the academy. PC culture is about this kind of tribal identity and victim status, right? If I can say I'm part Cherokee, for some reason I get a check because that's a victimized group, Native Americans. If I can say that that my group has been more victimized than another group, in other words, it has become an odd badge of honor. It's an unprecedented, it's almost like an anti-meritocracy.
Absolutely.
Right? It's a meritocracy of demerits, right? Yep. The more I've been sinned against, the more value I have in this new strange culture. So the question is how we got here. And so I want to ask you that. And then I want to ask you, in my book on Luther, I talk about how what the Reformation did is that it created this new level playing field where everyone was directly responsible to God. In other words, rather than say, I'm effectively a serf or a slave to the church state and I have to do what they tell me and I don't have to take responsibility. I only need to, tick the boxes and jump through the hoops that they insist that I tick or jump through, and then I'm good. Then suddenly Luther created a world, not necessarily intentionally, where everyone had this possibility of a direct relationship to God and therefore had to take responsibility for his own actions, his own, all of that kind of stuff. So it really led in my mind to self-government, yeah. to this idea that you are not going to tell me what to do. I have to figure out the truth. I answer to God. And, you know, there can be mediating institutions, but they have to line up with what is true. It's no longer merely about power. It's about truth. And I have this role. So in a sense, that freed Europe and the whole West to take a kind of personal responsibility, which you can say led to all kinds of good things in the free market in America, and that something happened. It's not just the Reformation, but in large part it's the Reformation that led us out of a kind of slavery. And it strikes me that the culture, the sexual revolution in the 60s that has led us to this place has almost brought us back into that kind of slavery. This is just a theory as I think of your stuff. So I just said I want to talk to you about all this stuff.
Yeah, well, I like the verb you use. Let's riff about it a bit, because this is the kind of stuff, if we weren't on air, I could sit here and riff with you about all day. It's one of my favorite subjects. You know, you've had on your show before Nancy Piercy, one of my favorite authors. Her book, Total Truth, kind of unpacks a little bit of this, I think, from a worldview standpoint and historically. I think that intellectually, the church and the sort of moral fabric of America found itself coming into the 20th century very beat up, very weakened, the effects of Darwinism. And as we sort of went into that kind of early 20th century humanism, the church at that point had been pretty cognizant of the fact that it was willing to be a sort of bystander to culture, that it was going to be somewhat disengaged and didn't feel intellectually invited. And they behaved as such throughout much of the 20th century. There were interruptions. There were certainly standouts. There were a lot of great exceptions to this. But by and large, the predominant cultural milieu, if you will, did not leave us a lot of shield against the forces of the sexual revolution.
Okay, that's an important point to make, and I hadn't really thought about. I mean, I've thought about this many times, and Nancy Piercy is a friend, but you're quite right that it's because of the church, let's say in the 20s, the Scopes trial is one of those, you know, signature moments in the culture or mark or milestones where you realize the church went separated from the wider culture in a way that gave free rein to the opposing forces in the wider culture.
And the church did it self-consciously.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you could argue that there's been certain subversive retreatism and so forth that has gone on. But this was really a pretty incredible, as far as since the Reformation, one of the most dangerous times in terms of church retreat from the culture, the early 20th century. I think that the 1960s come about, sexual revolutions taking place. The church largely had no antidote other than retreatism. And retreatism is not a very compelling message. Assimilation to the culture is a wonderfully adoptable message. But I've said this for many years ethically. I really stand by it now because so much of my book deals around the 10th commandment. I think covetousness is this sort of untalked about issue in the culture. But see, we basically said out of the sexual revolution, Roe v. Wade, that the 6th and 7th commandment didn't matter anymore. So the thou shalt not kill, commit adultery, sexual ethic, life, those things were dismissed. Why would we think 8th, 9th, and 10th commandments would hold up either in American life and in the ethos of our culture? So I believe that if I were looking at not just the timeline, that was the first thing I had to do. But see, I'm an economist, and so correlation and causation become tricky things at times. I'm very convinced that this disintegration did begin in the 1960s. Charles Murray's coming apart, I quote frequently throughout my book. But that didn't necessarily help with causation. That's what I think we're riffing about now, okay. And I think it's helpful.
All right. When we come back, I'm going to properly introduce my guest, David Bahnsen, as more than just the author of Crisis of Responsibility. But right now we're talking about his book, Crisis of Responsibility. And we will be right back to continue the conversation with David Bahnsen. While we were sleeping, a lot went down. 1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so. And this I know for sure. But does she really want to? Metaxas, the Eric Metaxas Show. I am talking to David Bahnsen, the author of Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. Fascinating conversation. I forgot to introduce you properly, David. First of all, Bahnsen is B-A-H-N-S-E-N, as in the German for train, Bahn. Bahnsen Group. You are the chief information officer.
Investment officer
of the Bahnsen Group, and you manage, what is it, like $1.5 billion in assets? Hey, who doesn't? You know what I'm saying? Before that, you spent 20 years as a managing director at Morgan Stanley. So that's your background. That's where you're coming from. You're on the board of the King's College. That's how I've gotten to know you. What a joy to know that you that they have access to your mind, acumen, wisdom. And you're also on the board at National Review. So we have a lot in common. We're talking about the thesis of your book, Crisis of Responsibility. And I was just throwing out there the idea that, you know, when you said it's about covetousness, it's about one of the commandments in the Bible, thou shalt not covet, but something has crept into our culture. It really is the PC culture, that somehow when you can have victim status, when you are given permission in a sense to covet, to say what you have, you don't deserve. You have white privilege, you have money, you have this, you have that. And people have been given permission. Isn't this like a kind of cultural Marxism?
Oh, it's very much a cultural Marxism. And it is actually the only part of Marxism, besides maybe some of the faculty lounges at Ivy League schools, that didn't die in 1990. I think the cultural Marxism that we're talking about is systemic, and I don't think it's widely understood how dangerous its implications are and how erosive it is to the American way of life. But I think when you talk about this issue of covetousness, it's really important to sort of identify or delineate why I believe it's unique versus rank and file sin or violation of a moral code.
Okay.
or whatnot. To me, what we are dealing with here that is unique, you talk about that problem of identity politics and political correctness. I think that has been around a long time, and I think it's mostly been monopolized by the left. I don't believe that the covetousness I'm referring to or the crisis of responsibility I wrote the book about is now monopolized by the left. I think it has sort of eked its way into the right as well, meaning the political right.
Okay, and how so?
And so by that I mean that when we look at the problems plaguing society, the normal cast of characters one may want to blame from that identity politics standpoint has been there, is still there. And the left will pull from it all the time. And probably it's even more radical than it's ever been, the white privilege and microaggressions and all these different things. It is, in a lot of ways, a very dangerous time to be a successful white heterosexual male in American culture. It's just true. However, I think that the right and in their justifiable disdain for big governmentalism and for leftism, big media and so forth has fallen into the trap of allowing the size of government to become a scapegoat for a lot of our cultural problems and gotten the cause and effect backwards.
Okay.
So what chapter 10 of my book seeks to do, and I think it's one of the more controversial elements, is basically say we didn't get big government and then get a poor self-governed culture. We had a poor self-governed culture, then we got big government. The cause and effect is backwards. And so I think that is sort of the thing that I'm hopeful people on the right who are somewhat sympathetic to the basic impulses of the book will see and maybe challenge their own thinking a little bit.
Well, so I'll give you an example of what somebody could do differently then when you're talking about this. In other words, when you say our addiction, cultural addiction to blame, how is that manifesting itself on the right? In other words, OK, we can blame big government. But it surely it goes beyond that.
Well, and I think there's a few different examples, and I would love to cheat and pick the least controversial ones. But the problem is the one probably best to use is this controversy right now around immigration. What I do, it's my favorite chapter in the book because I felt like it was very delicately written, but not because I was trying to play it safe, but because I truly believe in the delicacy I brought to that chapter.
Sure.
we have an illegal immigration problem, and it presents a national security threat, and it presents a whole number of other issues that rightly need to be dealt with. So I'm on the side of securing our border. I'm on the side of getting this right to protect American interests.
Right.
I believe that is categorically different from saying that illegal immigration is the reason that jobs are challenged in a steel town in Ohio. I think it's economically preposterous. I think most people know it is. What I try to do in the book is say we have a multiculturalism problem, a lack of assimilation. The Ellis Island immigration that most of us, myself included, believe in as a really fond and an important part of American
history.
Absolutely.
My parents are both legal immigrants to America.
And my great-grandparents as well from Denmark. And so the sort of European immigration we refer to is not just different from the current Mexican immigration because of ethnicity. It's different because of the entire objective in them coming here was to assimilate into American culture and contribute to American society and believe in sort of the creed of American life.
Well, also, not just to put it that way, but to go a step further and to say they were excited about it. They wanted to buy into it.
Risking life and treasure.
They saw something extraordinary. And in fact, what America is at its heart is absolutely extraordinary, singular. They appreciated it. The difference, of course, well, that's why to me the left really deeply cynically plays the race card. It's very ugly and pernicious because you're not talking about the color of people's skin. You're talking about the ethos. In other words, what are we doing when we say, you know, come on in and we'll let you, you know, cut our hedges? It's a whole different thing than the kind of immigration that my parents and
that's
many
right.
people's great-grandparents, and that's just what you've said. It's got nothing to do with race, but I guess I'm not clear.
So the blame casting I'm getting to is that we have a legitimate issue here with this that needs to be addressed, and yet we've migrated into, no pun intended, treating the subject as a scapegoat for American labor problems.
Okay.
And it isn't economically cogent. And in fact, I think it's not helpful to go through a full economic textbook as to why each immigrant, whether they should be here or not, is both at the same time they're competing for a low-skilled job.
Yeah.
They're also a new customer in society.
But I mean, look, I think there are many people, many conservatives, fiscal conservatives, who agree with you. But my question then is, what is at the heart? How does this connect to your thesis? What is at the heart of American labor that connects to this crisis of responsibility?
And so whether it be – that's a great question. Whether it be immigration or free trade or automation and these technological advancements, across the board, what we have is a complete death of labor dynamism, of labor mobility, that our labor force has completely stopped moving, either geographically moving, actually like getting up and going to where the jobs may be, or moving up in terms of
training. I get that, and I don't think a lot of people, too many people would disagree with that. I guess the question is, what does that have to do with crisis of responsibility? How does that attach to personal responsibility?
I don't agree that everybody agrees with it. I think that
I think a lot of people agree with the idea that you can't just slap on tariffs and put on a wall and we're gonna have a booming Detroit. It's not that simple.
But definitely not.
But what are you saying? How does this have to do with the crisis of responsibility?
I'm saying that fundamentally, borrowing a bit here from J.D. Vance's thesis in Hillbilly Elegy, that what you have are communities and pockets of middle America that are unrecognizable to what they were 50 years ago, and that the unrecognizableness of that is entirely related to the crisis of responsibility.
Now I finally know what you're getting at. You're really talking about something that I think does go back to the sexual revolution. It is the breakdown of the family and basic norms of culture.
Absolutely.
That lower and working class culture in America, whether white or black, we can focus on white, has devolved to where it's normal to live with a woman to whom you're not married. This is normative now. It was not normative in 1965. It's normative for families to operate that way, and it leads to all kinds of bad things. But I still think it goes back to the sexual revolution.
Well, I do as well. And I think that there's one particular social metric that I would even point out. And it's a big theme in chapter three of the book. The divorce rate, the not marrying somebody, the you know, pregnancies out of wedlock, all of these metrics are brutal. And they all started at the sexual revolution, have gotten only worse. And we see all that data going back to Charles Murray's Coming Apart. What about the men living at home till they're 33, 34 years old?
When we come back, we're going to talk about the men living at home in a perpetual adolescence unto death. We'll be right back.
Big, bright, shiny yellow sun, come and watch your children play. They think you're the only one who can make them feel this way.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I am talking to David Bahnsen, author of a great book, Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. We were just trying to get to the root of this, David, I was trying to get to the root of how this relates to your thesis, that when you look at, let's say, working class, middle class, lower class whites in America, an ethos has taken hold. This is, in other words, that we're not talking now about the cult. We're not talking about the victimhood of the left and that kind of thing. We can set that to the side. We're talking about middle America, a lot of people who voted for Trump. And you're saying that we have a crisis in those communities. That's at the heart of our problems. I would agree with you. I would always say that it is a cultural crisis. I have said this. It's not a fiscal crisis. It's not an economic crisis. It's not a political crisis. It's a cultural crisis that when you have most of America adopting views on sexuality, views on what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a husband, a father. When all of that stuff changes over 4 or 5 decades to where we are today, I would argue that that is the real problem. And it strikes me that that's what you're saying, at least in part, in your book.
Very much so. And using that theme of the financial crisis again, one of the points I make in the book is that the culture that has, as we've been talking about, put such a low value on family and a low value on home should not have been surprised that people began looking at their houses as trading cards. The house itself had very little economic value when the home had very little cultural value.
Whoa, that is heavy. I want to get back before we get into that. I want to get back to you were talking about men in their 20s and 30s living at home. That to me is something I talk about a lot of times. I want to say to these young men, hey, be a man. Being a man means you need to step up. You need to get a job. Find a woman you are worthy of, raise a family. You know, previous generations had that. They basically said, you know, if you're hanging around the house at age 30, that's just not going to work.
Or 20.
There's none of this is going to work. So the idea that this is normative now, I think is I would say harming the young men more than anybody. It affects everybody. But I'm looking at these young men and I'm thinking that these are the prime years of your life. You should be fighting, battling, working. And what are you doing? You've got a girlfriend, you sleep with her, but you haven't committed your life to her. If you get her pregnant, well, probably she'll have an abortion, or you don't know what you want to do. I mean, it strikes me that, again, that is at the heart of all of our problems, is that ethos.
Absolutely. And I would actually say there's two different problems that you're identifying at once. One is the young man himself and his own lack of character and maturity and the poor behavior that goes along with it. But number two is the society that enables it. This is the problem I have. How many people are willing to look upon that and just sort of say, okay, anything goes. We condone it. David Brooks has written some excellent stuff over the years about this sort of odyssey phase that we have kind of put into our expectations of young people, that they get an extra 10 years of odyssey, of adolescence. I don't think it's 10 anymore. I think the data shows it's going into maybe 15 years, mid-30s, very common, where people start to settle down and say, okay, now I want to grow up a little bit. I do believe you said something before about what's bad for that young man. It's really interesting because it's easy for me as being a cultural critic from the vantage point of writing this book to identify what this epidemic is doing to the society economically, culturally. Right. But I also feel for those people. They're being robbed of their dignity.
Correct.
They're being robbed of their capacity for production. And I think that that takes away what God created them to be. And it's a tragedy.
Well, but again, I do think you could very easily and correctly blame the left. In other words, the cultural left in this country gained power with the rise of the media culture. In other words, if you make the case that the artists and the storytellers and all that, they've always been there. But once they got the megaphone of a media culture, their influence dramatically increased and they were able to affect the people who consume that media culture. And so from the 60s on, and you could trace this beyond the 60s into the 50s and the Beats and Jack Kerouac, but this kind of this sort of hippie mode, this kind of thing, it was sold as a narrative, as a positive narrative, and we've never gone back. So for me, it is a cultural problem because we've sold this idea that why settle down? Enjoy yourself. You know, these are lies from the pit of hell because, in fact, for everybody who enjoys himself and is able to, you know, pull out of the death spiral, there are 10 who suffer. There are women who never get married, who wanted to have families, that we really we never talk about that. We have really become addicted to that narrative. We can't pull out of that. And I really do think that this is at the heart. You're never hearing what you and I are talking about now. One never hears in the culture. You don't hear this on Fox News. No. You don't hear this anywhere.
No, and it's interesting because I would agree with you it's cultural, but I'm not sure that it is politically cultural, meaning left-right politically, as much as even socioeconomically. We're sitting here in Manhattan. It is totally unacceptable in this strata for a 25-year-old person to be uneducated, uninterested in life, in production, in work. And right-leaning.
We're going to a hard break. Forgive me. Hold on to that sentence, folks. We'll be right back talking to David Bahnsen.
Feeling like I don't belong.
Hey there, folks. Before we hear about Jackie Blue, I'm going to just jump right in here. I want to mention Hillsdale because in this hour, I'm so caught up in this great conversation with David Bahnsen, A Crisis of Responsibility. I want to mention that Hillsdale College is doing this crazy thing. They're sending copies of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence to literally every single public high school and every single public middle school principal in America, with the larger goal of getting these incendiary, crazy documents into the hands of children. Can you believe this, folks? Into the hands of children. If you want to find more about this wild social experiment, go to metaxasforhillsdale.com. That's metaxasforhillsdale.com. It's pretty spooky. All right, we're getting back to the conversation with David Bahnsen. David, you were just riffing and I had to cut you off. My apologies. Go ahead.
Well, so I think the point I was making is that in a sort of left-leaning city like Manhattan, it would be unacceptable for a 25-year-old male to be living at home, not doing anything. And in a right-leaning city like Scottsdale, Arizona, or Newport Beach, California, it would be unacceptable. But it's when you go into certain pockets of middle America, whether they be more left-leaning or right-leaning politically, unfortunately, this seems to be epidemic across much of a middle class and lower class, the acceptability of it. So this is where I very much bought into it. It's not common for Christians to talk this way. I very much bought into there being two problems here. The issue of the young man living at home for 15 years and the issue of people like us not judging it. We have to judge it. We have to call it out. The society needs to take a more judgmental, not less judgmental attitude.
This is incredible. I agree with you totally. I don't know how many people agree with you on this. I couldn't agree more. I have effectively said this here and there. I've never spoken exactly about it the way we're talking about it now, but I've said precisely the same thing. That what, I mean, look, let's look at it traditionally. What have fathers done in the past? The father is there to smack his son in the back of the head hard if necessary. You hope it's not necessary. You hope that by the time the kid is old enough, the father doesn't even think about doing that because he's already trained this kid in the way he should go. But this is what fathers do. Mothers aren't made by God to do this. This is one of these things that, again, because of we're talking about the cultural confusion, the gender confusion, all this kind of stuff right now, traditional roles. I wrote my book, Seven Men, in large part speaking to this issue. I said, what does it mean to be a man today? What does it mean to be a man? We don't talk about that. In the past, we would say, hey, be a man. And it meant something. Today, you'd say, well, what do you mean be a man? Are you saying I'm a sissy? Are you anti-gay? What are you saying? We've confused things. And we've robbed people of some things that are that give us a fundamental identity and that give us pride in ourselves and so on and so forth. So the idea that we ought to be judging this, I mean, the question is how one judges it, what one says. This is at least the beginning.
Well, that's right. And obviously the mannerism and the approach and the, all those things are important. But my point is that the taking pride in a posture of non-judgmentalism, this idea of refusing to preach what we practice, there is a playbook for how to function at a high level in the global economy. It is very evidenced in affluent places like parts of Manhattan, parts of Newport Beach, two cities I happen to live in. The people there are the least likely to ever go tell folks in struggling pockets of America what maybe they're doing wrong. And that, to me, is the problem. They almost sort of celebrate the fact that there is a kind of immobility in much of the country when, in fact, the playbook for good family living, responsible decision making, so forth and so on, obviously works.
But you know what that's called, right? That's called hypocrisy.
That's right.
Yeah. It's called hypocrisy. And that's one of the things that we're given permission in this culture to judge hypocrisy. It's kind of the one sin culturally that we can call out.
But I think hypocrisy. We're used to thinking of hypocrisy as I'm doing something wrong and I'm telling you not to do it. In this case, what I'm saying is there's certain people doing something right and they're afraid to tell people to do it.
Well, that's right.
And so it's turned around a bit, but it's the same point.
But it's the same point. That if you want to succeed, you need to do this. But it's sort of funny because this is such a big problem that, to try to get under it and put your shoulder to this wheel. This is a big wheel we're talking about here.
Well, and this chicken or egg issue is important. We talked about it a few moments ago as it pertains to the size of government. Do we have too big of a government because the people have failed, or have the people failed because we have too big of a government? And you brought up the feminism issue a moment ago and how there's this sort of confusion about gender in American society and men feel emasculated. They're on the couch till 30 playing video games. Well, it is my position that there's no chicken or egg controversy. I think the reason that we have this advent of radicalized feminism is because of the failure of men to step up. But at this point, it's a negative feedback loop. It's feeding on each other.
That's right.
And the only solution to the vicious cycle is the crisis of responsibility to come out of that.
It is to come out of that, right. And, I said a smack in the back of the head earlier. A kick in the butt is another way you can put it. But it's funny because to me it falls to men to do that. If a woman is yelling at her son, it kind of becomes a nagging thing and the son reacts in a certain way to that. Men... In a funny way, know how to deal with other men. They know it's about respect on some level. It's not I'm disrespecting you. I'm respecting you by kicking you in the butt. And it's received differently. And again, it is the breakdown of traditional gender roles that feeds into this. Look, you can lay the blame anywhere. You could go back to Hugh Hefner and the Playboy mentality. I mean, that what a horrible message to send. Hey, have some fun. Use some women for your pleasure. until you get tired of it. That's the most anti-woman message you could ever give. And that's been a message we've been giving to men. And in a way, women have been trying to figure out how to deal with that. Yeah. Now, of course, we have the Me Too crisis, but it's amazing that.
But even in the Me Too crisis, like if we were not in a crisis of responsibility, wouldn't the immediate impulse of those that have had enough, that are, what is it, time's up, wouldn't it be to say, geez, hasn't this sexual revolution sort of created this? Has our overly accommodative, promiscuous ideology perhaps been the genesis of the movement, of the problems that created it? So there doesn't seem to me to be a real interest in honest diagnosis.
Right.
And I think that's the need of the hour.
Yeah, well, that's exactly correct, that the sexual revolution has led to this. And I do know I've said that on this program and others have said it, but it's not the rallying cry of the Me Too movement. We'll be right back talking to David Bahnsen on the Eric Metaxas Show. Texas Show, a little Jerry Rafferty for you today. I'm talking to David Bahnsen about his book, Crisis of Responsibility. David, this is so important. I hardly know where to go. We've just got a few minutes left in this hour. But what does one do about this? I mean, I think talking about it is the first step. But it's kind of, we're talking about everything.
Well, and that's one of the things that's been fun for me doing kind of the media tour around the book, is there's so many topics you can talk about. The book sort of goes into multiple subjects. But yeah, that's the number one question that needs to be addressed. Where do we go from here? And so that's why I wrote not one, but two chapters to answer it. There's a chapter in the book dedicated entirely to the top 10 things individuals can do to now go try to apply this to reverse the crisis of responsibility in their own lives from the bottom up. And then the final chapter of the book is more the cultural message, where we go from here and what is needed. I do think every now and then, I don't know you well enough to know if you tend naturally to be more optimistic or more cynical. I consider myself a very optimistic person, but a lot of these topics can create a certain cynicism and so forth. And I have to say, I'm very optimistic about where we will go as a culture. I don't know when. I don't know exactly how. I am amazed at how quickly things are transforming these days in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
Most of the time people say that now. They're talking about technology as if it's some profound thing to say, look at what the iPhone has done.
Yeah.
No, I mean something different than that. I believe that when you look at the millennial culture, which is much maligned and often for good reason, the reality is you don't have a millennial culture. You have almost three distinct ones. There is a bottom 50%, if you will. It's pretty bad. I won't go there. There's a middle pack that is usually what people mean when they're talking about millennials, this sort of stereotype about them being entitled or something. But boy, you look at that top 20%. There's never been anything like it. They are the most productive, proactive, intelligent, I mean, brutally capable parts of our society right now. The top 20% of people between age 20 and 30, let's say. I think we have opportunity to reverse this. And I talk in the book about families rethinking the way they approach higher education. Mm. I think institutions like Hillsdale and King's College, we underestimate the impact that they will have.
I agree.
50 years out.
Absolutely.
And yet, fundamentally, at the bottom up, when it comes down to our individual role and what we can do and what somebody listening right now, they have got to start with repudiating an attitude of victimhood, of saying defeatism will not occupy space in my heart or soul. And the challenging part, Eric, is I'm actually saying that even if they really were a victim, even if they actually have been mistreated.
But that's exactly right. And here's the main reason, because it doesn't work. That's the main thing. It doesn't mean you might not have been raped or might not have been abused violently or might, in other words, all of that stuff. But the point is that hanging on to that will abuse you more.
The only thing created out of an attitude of victimhood is a victim.
This is such a big subject. Unfortunately, we're out of time. David Bahnsen, I know that you're not far from here. Can I bother you to come back to continue this conversation?
Would love to.
I would love it as well. David Bahnsen, thank you. Folks, the book is Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It. This is big stuff, folks. Thanks for listening. Just all right, but yeah.